born William Taylor. I was born in Cordova, Alaska, January the 13th, 1926. I was raised and went through the public school system in Cordova until 1940, at which time the family moved to Kodiak, where my father was in the practice of law, established a practice there. I finished high school in Kodiak. I had 3 years of schooling there, high school. Upon graduating from high school in 1943, I went into the United States Navy. Prior to that, I attended one semester at the at Washington, which was then Washington State College, and it's now, I think they've changed the name, I can't recall, but at any rate, it's the one at Pullman. I think they changed the name of these institutions to confuse people. Like the radio stations now have new call numbers, and that's just an aside for the record. I went into the United States Navy, completed 2 years of service. The war was over. I went to the University of Washington for a year in undergraduate work. I took a year off, attended the University of Alaska for 3 years. I then went to Cumberland University in Tennessee, where I matriculated, LLB, which was later converted to a JD. Again, I don't know how they do that, but I came back to Alaska, and in 1951, the summer of 51, I went straight through school. I didn't take any. I took one summer off. The second summer I did not take off. I went on through, and I graduated out of sync with the rest of the class that I went in with in the fall of, I can't remember what year that would have been now, but when I came back to Alaska, my father was in practice here and had been for a number of years in Fairbanks. When I was in the Navy, he had moved to Fairbanks. So he'd been here for a few years and had established a practice here. And a young man that I had known in school graduated a year ahead of me, and he was enamored of Alaska, and he was working with my father, Gene Miller, Eugene B. Miller, who is retired and is living in Missouri. I went to work in the office more as a embryonic lawyer, because they didn't have clerkships at the time, and I took the bar in October of 1951, and was not admitted until March of 1952. It was they say it was the year that the bar examination was not graded. That's how they refer to it by people that took that bar exam. I can't remember even now who some of the other people were that took it, but they only gave it in Anchorage, and I had to drive. I drove down with another fellow, and I can't remember his name, but we drove down in October and took the bar examination and came back, and then I continued on with the same kind of work that I was doing, working in the law office. My dad had a grab bag kind of a case load. He was always, he, and suppose later on this will come out, but he was always representing the indigent people. He also had people that were pretty good paying clients too, but by and large his clientele was, or a lot of the time was taken up with people who he felt that had some injustice done to them by the criminal justice system, some aspect of it. Of course, we didn't call it the criminal justice system then. That's something that's come about in more recent years. That was when I was admitted was shortly after we received notification of the bar, and that was being admitted into the territorial bar.
Oh, I see. So you got into the state bar in 55.
Did I say 55, 52?
55.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm getting my dates confused. And I was admitted in 55. It was 54 when I took the exam. I think it was like 52 when I went into law school.
Mm-hmm.
That brings about. Thank you.
Can I ask you about Cordova?
Sure.
What was your dad doing in Cordova?
My dad was there were two lawyers in town, he and Clyde Ellis. And Clyde Ellis was a Republican and my dad was a Democrat. And when the fortunes changed, political fortunes changed, whoever happened to be in the federal presidency, and be it Democrat or Republican, when the Republicans are in, Clyde Ellis was in the district attorney's office, and when the Democrats were in, my dad was in the district attorney's office. Anchorage was not the headquarters of the court system at that time. Valdez was. I remember him prior to his practicing law, but I don't remember too much about it because I know that he had an interest in it. I think he owned, not an interest in, but owned the a pool hall, card room, card room, cigar store, tobacco shop, and a restaurant. And then he had been, prior to that time, he had been on working for the railroad. Before he went in the World War I, he was working for the railroad, and when the war started, he enlisted and went over to France, came back, went to work for the railroad again, and then he started reading law.
What did he read in?
He read in the law offices of Tony Diamond. Diamond and Donahue also had, this brings to mind that there were more than two lawyers in town, because Diamond and Donahue also had an office there.
Mm-hmm.
But not that I can recall right now. I remember Diamond and Donahue because it brings it to mind about the fact that their law office was just a hop, skip, and a jump down the street from where we lived. But I never remember my dad having a law office as such. It seems to me at that time, maybe because it was a Roosevelt era, and that would have been 1932. Roosevelt was in 32, 50 years ago. Holy smokes. I've derailed myself a bit.
Oh, that's right. When did your father first start practicing? Do you know the year?
I think it was 1926, and I think I have his certificate around here someplace. I can't when I'm all hooked up with this thing, but I think someplace I think I've got it here.
So 1926, he had been clerking with Diamond.
Well, he hadn't been clerking. He'd been what they call reading law. And while he was operating the locomotive from the Copper River Northwestern Railroad, the CRNNW was what it was, and it was always affectionately referred to as the Can't Run and Never Will Railroad, the CRNNW. It's aside. He was reading law, and he would, as I understand, the way that the bar examiner, the way that they admitted a person, they didn't give a a written examination. They gave an oral examination, and I can't for I don't know now who the judge was. It might have been Tony Diamond.
Was Joe Murray important?
Either there or Valdez. I'm not sure.
Did the Valdez lawyers come to
Cordova? Oh, yeah, they're very close, yeah. And if there were... matter of fact, Diamond ended up, I think, had his place or his office in... what was that? Get that straightened out, too, about the... well, maybe your questions will help probe.
Who else was in Valdez? Do you remember Valdez?
No.
Did the Seward attorneys ever come over to Cordova?
I don't think so. The closest that they might have come to that was when they had what they called a floating court. I don't know certainly somebody must have told you about the floating court by now. But I just know because I was on one of the trips and we went to Seward on the Coast Guard cutter. And it was part of the 3rd Judicial District and that's where they went. Beautiful boat. I can remember being, of course, I was, I guess maybe I have an affinity toward the ocean anyway, and then why am I sitting here in Fairbanks, you know, for all these years and saying that. But the Coast Guard cutter, and every once in a while, Navy ships would come in, you know, and I guess because of that, I just have a real fondness for the sea and the ships. But the Coast Guard cutter was beautiful boats, and I remember the trips that we take, that they would assemble the judge and his secretary and a clerk and a marshal or two, and then they'd have somebody from the prosecutors from the district attorney's office, and they'd have maybe one or two of the defense bar, you know, go along, and they'd go out, and then they'd conduct court in each of on the ship, and they would conduct the court like that. And I was exposed to it at a very tender age. Probably I couldn't have been much more than 12 mm-hmm. at the time when this happened. And he went as prosecutor. Yeah, at least on one trip that I remember. And whether he was ever went as a defense member of the defense bar, I don't know. I don't know that. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Did he go with
I don't know about Hill, but I'm pretty sure that's what I was trying to think, I guess, and I lost my train of thought. It was either Diamond, when taking that bar examination, because he told me how that happened. It was either, if Diamond was on the bench at the time, and I don't think he was, it must have been Hellenthal. But what they did, they went before the judge, and there was two... I think he said that there were two other lawyers there that had already been admitted, and they would ask him questions, and the judge would ask him questions, and based upon the answers, questions and the answers, that they either were admitted or not admitted. And he said that's the way he was admitted, by taking an examination like that.
Did the Attorney General have anything to do with
it? Seems to me not. Mm-hmm. But since I wasn't there... I really don't know, but this is, again, just something that he had mentioned several times and how he was admitted.
Okay. So he was a lawyer in Cordova until 1940?
I'd say about 1939,
did
something
like that.
In Cordova, no. Not that I know of. I think when he might, whether or not he conducted it was called the club. That was this business of the having the cigar and the tobacco store and the restaurant, pool hall and card room and all that stuff. If he did that at the same time that he was practicing law, I don't know. But I remember when we lived over, there was an apartment over the club. And I remember we lived there. And sometime later, then my dad bought a house a couple of streets up from maybe just one street up from that, from the main section of town. And that's where... principally where I remember growing up in. I remember the club. You know, that's really vague in the back of my mind, but I remember the other house because we were there for quite a few years.
So there was enough of a presence
I would think so. Yeah, I don't have any reason to believe that he had any other businesses unless it was a club. I don't know when he sold the club. I know he sold it, but I don't know when.
Is it still there?
Still there. Mm-hmm.
When he moved to Korea, why did you move to Korea?
Well, Cordova at that time, the Copper River, or the Kennecott mines were closing, had closed already. I remember being down at the ocean dock, and they were loading the locomotives and cars and stuff. As I understood at that time, that they were taking him to Japan, and I thought, later on it was rather ironic that we're shipping over the same stuff that they ended up shooting back at us, but that was my understanding of it, and where it really went to, I don't know. The mines had closed, and there just wasn't that much activity there to warrant somebody that wanted to practice law and that was progressive, wanted to get something, get ahead. And Kodiak at that time was booming because there was a lot of, they were building the Navy base. And there was a lot of activity there. There was a lot of construction going on, and it was just a logical place to, for somebody that wanted to get in on the ground floor. Well, I can't say that, because I remember going to Anchorage with my dad as a kid, and he was in the district attorney's office at the time, and I remember us going. I tell you, I can't remember how we got there. We would have had to have flown, I think. I'm sure we had to fly in. Well, there was no railroad between Cordova and Anchorage. Matter of fact, there never has been, and there probably never will be, but... we might have gone to Seward and then taken the train. I kind of think that that's what we did. We might have taken a regular, one of the Alaska steamship boats to Seward, and then I know we didn't fly. There was another flying trip that came later, but in a small plane. But we took a boat to Seward and then went to on the train from Seward to Anchorage. And I remember being in downtown Anchorage, and there was zero. There was nothing there. I mean, think about, the opportunities that passed. And if you'd had $10,000, you could have probably bought all of downtown Anchorage. And but my dad was thinking about moving to Anchorage, and he was. I remember us going out to a place. There was a house. It was probably, within walking distance of the courthouse. So it probably couldn't have been much more than. Maybe six blocks or something like that from the courthouse, which is the old courthouse on 4th. And I remember that building being there. And he looked at the house, and I think with the intent, the idea that perhaps he was going to buy it and move to Anchorage. Instead, I can't remember what year that was, but sometime later, I remember that we didn't move to Anchorage. But he did move to Kodiak, and because Anchorage, I'm sure, was on the move at the time. They had to have been, because there was certainly a lot of military buildup in Anchorage as a result of the oncoming war and things like that. But I think maybe because, there was, as I recall, there was only one attorney in Kodiak, Talmadge Smith. Talmadge, T-A-L-M-A-D-G, Talmadge Smith, was the only attorney in Kodiak, and my dad must have sensed some opportunity there and went there to establish a practice, which he did, and then he moved the family there. Well, there was just, my sister was outside, and she'd gotten married and was gone. Really out of it, not as part. She didn't move with us. She'd already gone outside. But it would be my dad, mother, and myself, just the three of us. And my dad at that time had bought some property in Kodiak and had built an apartment house. And there were a number of apartments in the apartment house. And of course, that was a pretty good adventure because of the shortage of space that was becoming a real reality because of so many people were coming into Kodiak and they needed some housing. period paragraph, I guess.
So he had both the legal practice and the apartment house.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and then he got in. Did get involved further in real estate too. Yeah. Well, there was some. I think because of the expansion of Kodiak and the fact that so many people were coming in, and there were homesteads, and he got involved with developers in buying homesteads and subdividing and things like that.
During the time he was in Cordova, was he in the state legislature, the territorial legislature?
I'm sure he was in the territorial legislature, and I probably should sit down sometime and document what years those were. Because I'm not sure if he now has, or if John, what's John's last name? Butrovich, if he has more years of service or not. I think maybe John has, but at one time I know my dad did.
Yeah.
Had more years of legislative service, and I know he'd served in the legislature from the 3rd district, and he also did from the 4th district too.
And was he actively campaigning in your youth? Do you ever remember him?
I'd never remember him campaigning.
Well,
I can't say that. In my, you know, I just don't remember him, because I don't think we, any time that he was ever, had ever gone to the legislature, we as a family, you know, the family did not go to the legislature, did not go to Juneau as such.
How often was he in the legislature? Do you remember him being away or not?
No. I can remember him being away, but I can't remember being away a lot, because I really don't know that, I'd have to think back now and if the legislature, if their sessions were every other year or every year. Yeah, well, that's really not too much time when you consider what they're doing nowadays, and they're gone every year, and at that time it was a limited session and every other year, so it really probably didn't seem like that much time, and I may not have even sensed, you know, that it was during school, you know, the kids are involved in other activities, and I just have to pick out, you know, find out what those years were, when he was in the legislature. I've just never taken the time to do it.
Why did you leave Kodiak?
Kodiak had, let's see, that was when I was...
1940?
No, we went to Kodiak about 1939. I think we left Kodiak... Well, I wasn't really what you'd consider a member of the family then. I was gone. I was off in the killing Japs. Yes. That's not a good expression, I guess, anymore. But that's you know, the war was on, and I was away. And Dad moved, and they came to Fairbanks. And I'd have to guess that was probably in maybe 45. And I suspect that the reason probably was that that Fairbanks was in on the in a growth pattern, and it must have appealed to him as maybe being a better place to practice.
Never Anchorage.
No.
Did your father have a law office in either Cordova or Columbia?
Had one in Kodiak, as we had a. In conjunction with, but not connected to, the apartment house was a combination law office and residence.
Mm-hmm.
And the law office was in the front part of the building, and we lived in the back part of it.
What did he have in his law office? Do you remember
what it was like? No, probably. Two rooms, you know, probably one reception room, and then a more or less private office.
Did he have a secretary?
Mm-hmm.
He did.
Mm-hmm.
Did they have typewriters?
You know, I can remember no dictating equipment as such. I can remember a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
but no mechanical or electronic dictating equipment, I'm sure of that. But I remember being in Donahue's office. Tom Donahue had three boys, rough and tough Irish kids. And one of them was my age, and one of them was maybe a year older, and one was a year younger. So we spent a lot of time together. Excuse me, and because his dad's office was right down the street, and if we wanted something, whoever's dad was closest, hit him up for 25 cents or something. And I remember going into his office and seeing the thing that cuts the wax cylinder and for a dictating equipment.
So he had the wax cylinder?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Did he have any secretaries?
Donahue?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure he must have. I don't know.
Do you know when Donahue came?
No.
Because one of the sons that he was pal Brown with was also returning later?
Not that I know of. I don't think so. I don't think any of them went into the law. You mean in Anchorage,
yeah,
you think?
Yeah.
Is that right? Do I have a... Well, that there, let's see, was Tom Jr. Pardon?
What were the sons' names?
I'm trying to think of that. Bobby?
Huh? Was there Tom Jr.?
Tom Jr., Tom Robert, and I think it was Dickie, Richard.
Tom would be the one.
And practice in Anchorage.
With J. Gerald Williams for a little while. In the late 1900s.
Donohoe?
Mm-hmm.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, I'll be darned, that's interesting. Because I don't think I've ever heard of any of those boys probably not since I left Cordova.
He died in the game. I can't
remember. Well, I'll be darned, that's amazing. Well. Okay.
But his father, their office had all the, was it the big law office?
I remember that there were the two of them, Donahue and Diamond. But now how much time Diamond actually spent there, I don't know. I really don't. I remember one time, and I suspect one of the questions you asked me at the beginning was, why did I want to be a lawyer?
Yeah.
I didn't want to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I wanted to be a judge, when my dad and I took that trip to Anchorage, one of the things he went there for, and I'm sure it was probably on, as being prosecutor, he probably had business with with that office. We went in, and my dad knew Tony Diamond really well, and I was very much impressed. I was thoroughly impressed with just the stature of the man himself, and he was a real gentleman and very cordial and. It just, I thought, gee whiz, I was in a very impressionable age. If that's what a judge is, I want to be a judge.
Uh-huh.
And
did you know Diamond before he became a judge?
I don't think so. No, as a matter of fact, I may have seen him, I may have even been in his company at time, but at that time I was fairly young and not too interested in older folks.
Yeah. What impressed you?
I think just the man of a lot of dignity. His son shows that, too. John.
Were there any other lawyers besides Thomas Smith?
Not that I know of.
So it was just your dad and Mr. Smith?
Mm-hmm. It was, I'd say it was probably, maybe, I'm not sure if it was 44 or 45, something. Because like I say, I was gone. I was off doing other things. As a matter of fact, well, at any rate, I wasn't attuned to what was happening. You know, the kids don't correspond. And my mother admonished me about that. Matter of fact, I got called in by the Red Cross one time, and he said, please write your mother. So that's kind of a correspondent I was, and I still am this time. But I was gone, and there was the move made.
When
I came back, I came back to Fairbanks.
What was
Fairbanks was a muddy, dirty town. Lots of activity. They were building, they were still building, matter of fact, out at here at what they call Ladd Field and is now Fort Wainwright. It was an air base, and they were doing a lot of construction work out there, and there was a lot of construction work going on in the area. I think, as a matter of fact, I'm not sure exactly when they started the base out at 13 Mile. They called it 13 Miles, now Allison, but that was some of the activity that was going on. There was just a lot of activity going on in the area. The town was, a lot of the town is still here, unfortunately. But like Second Avenue is evident of that fact. But there was a lot of activity. The university hadn't really started to grow yet. Matter of fact, I saw in the paper just the other day of the university campus, and they showed some pictures of like when they first started. I think it was 1919 or something, whenever it first started, and there was one or two buildings on the hill, and then the next picture was 1929, and there was a few more buildings, and I said to myself, that was that 1929 picture is the same way as I remember that campus in 1946. That was my recollection. I couldn't, you know, pick out that there were more or less buildings. If there were more buildings in 1946, I knew that there were because, matter of thinking of it now, they had a surplus barracks that they bought to house the new students in that were coming back from the war. For principally, it was called the Veterans Dormitory. And they set that up on the campus, and later on it was more or less temporary, and then later on it was sold, and somebody moved it, and they used it for a housing business complex later on, and then I'm sure it was subsequently destroyed, because like those wooden barracks are really temporary. But
did your father encourage you to become a
lawyer? I don't recall of any real encouragement as such. I suppose if anything, if there was any encouragement at all, it was that to read. The whole family were voracious readers, and anything we'd get our hands on. I whether it's true or not, but they say I was reading when I was five. That's hard to believe when you go to school and you see kids that can, you know, picking out A, B's, and C's, you know, when they're six, you know, and they said that I was reading the newspaper at five. Well, you know, I'd like to accept that, but I don't know whether it's true.
When you started to practice, or when you think about being a lawyer, did you think politics or laws, did they mix? Were they?
Never thought about it. Never.
Your father had been heavily involved in politics.
Yeah, but that was something that was not, I wasn't tuned into that. Mm-hmm. Not at all. Well, I knew that he was, you know, that he was involved in the Democratic Party, and rather, I'd say, you know, distinguished from in a matter of degree, rather heavily, and was, you know, in later years was considered, you know, they would say Mr. Democrat, you know, and as epitomizing, you know, that this is the, you know, the party person, and but being aware of it. I don't know. I don't think so. You know, having that sense of somebody beings. He's your dad, you know. So what difference is if he's an undertaker or if he whatever, you know, this is my dad. So as far as being aware of the fact that he was in the legislature, and I can't say that I ever really did, you know, believe, you know, or have that, you know, as a prime belief, you know, that he was also a member of the legislature, even having awareness, you know, what is a legislature? You know, I got a red bicycle. That's, you know, that's better than the legislature. I got a dog, you know. You talk about things that are really important and close to you. You don't talk about something as, you know, ethereal as a legislature. What's a legislature?
So it wasn't important to you?
I don't think so. Not at that time.
What did it ever become important?
I ran for office.
When?
When statehood came and they had the... They set up the boroughs, and they had an election in to fill borough offices, and I ran for the Fairbanks. It wasn't then the Fairbanks North Star Borough. It was the what'd they call it? The name was changed later, but it was the North Star Borough. Or it was the Fairbanks. Yeah, can't even think of the name of it now. But it was the geographic land that encompassed Fairbanks, but it also went all the way out to the border. It was an extremely huge geographical mass. It still is, but in the time that I was elected and I served and I was presiding officer, and the borough was curtailed in its size, cut back on the geographical limitations quite a bit. I hope I'm right on the dates. Hope you check them out. I'm not under oath.
Would you think you came up with 42? That was before you joined the Monsters.
Yeah.
What did you do up there?
In 1946, when I got out of the service, I went to work for the municipal utility system. And I worked in their... as the in the coal testing department, and to determine the burning qualities. In other words, when a coal car came in from Healy, and then I would sample the coal to determine the quality of it, if it was something that the city, you know, or at that time, if the city should be buying the coal or not, to determine. And it was just, you know, to process it that way. I worked also briefly as I started out, I guess, as an engineering aide, you know, to hold one end of a tape or hold a rod or something like that. And a friend of mine he wasn't the city engineer, but he was an engineer and worked for the city. We'd been in the Navy together, and he'd gotten out, came up here. But the job with the city didn't last, I think, probably just for the summer, and then I went to school.
In Fairbanks?
In Fairbanks, yeah. The university, and I lived on campus we didn't have the veterans dorm right away. We lived in the bottom or in the basement of what was Hess Hall. I think Hess Hall, I'm not sure if Hess Hall is still there or not. It had been a women's dormitory, and because there were so many male students that were coming out of the service and going to the university, they needed more room, so they blocked off, or I guess they thought, the administration thought they blocked off the access to the, you know, so there'd be zero communications, but it wasn't too successful, but there were 12 of us that lived in the basement of Hess Hall, and we were called the Groundhogs. Well, Cordova, when you grow up in a town, a hometown has different connotations, I guess, to different people. And you become really familiar, and it's, even if you lived in a 2 or 3 block radius, you never saw the rest of the town, that's still hometown, and your conceptions of a hometown are what you did and, you know, where you were in that period of time. I went back to Cordova in 1959. I think it was 1959. And it was a shock to me. I don't think Cordova had changed. I had changed. It was a shock because my idea of Cordova wasn't the same as when I was growing up. I guess I'd been away too long for one thing, and I'd seen other things happen, other places, and been in other towns, and you get familiar with other things. But distances. When I was a kid, of course, your legs are shorter, and you don't get to get that far from home. I had a concept of distances being tremendous, but when I went back, you know, and here I was, 30 some years old, and it seemed like it was, you know, there was no time, no space at all, or distance involved in from one place to another. And I used to think of it as a terrific adventure, you know, to go from one place to another. And there was a place called the Red Dragon Library, and Sidney Lawrence had something to do with that, as I think I recall just recently reading about that. To walk all the way over to the Sidney Lawrence Library, it seemed like that was a half a day trip. You know, you packed your lunch and hoped you didn't get eaten up by bears on the way there. And later on, I find out it's probably not more than 3 blocks, you know, maybe at the most. Things like that, those concepts. Kodiak was different because there was so much going on. The activity was tremendous. I mean, there were troops coming through, troop ships. They were Navy ships of all sizes. There were submarines and there were aircraft. And the place was just going like 60. When the war actually broke out, the military dependents were ordered out of Kodiak. So immediately, most of the kids that I was going to school with were taken, you know, they were shipped out. And I don't think any of them stayed, matter of fact. Those that were not military dependents, of course, didn't have to go. We lived through that initial period of the war when they bombed Dutch Harbor, and we were, you know, operating in a blackout condition, you know, so make sure that the Japanese didn't find their way into our living rooms. So Kodiak, you know, was different. It was an entirely different atmosphere. I suppose that people that lived in, of course, London is no comparison because they actually were bombed. But
what did people think of Lawyers?
I think in those two communities, I think that Lawyers were very highly thought of. Mm-hmm. That the public opinion of a lawyer was much more than it is now. I would hope, you know, that lawyers were not some of the, you know, the outcasts of so-called, you know. But lawyers, in my opinion, at least at that time, that people thought highly of lawyers as members of the community, somebody to look up to. And I think in both Cordova and Kodiak, I remember that one of the things that my dad got some notoriety on was that General Coryell, if I'm not mistaken. I knew the name because his son was there and we palled around together. But he had ordered the military dependents out of Alaska, and some military dependent came to my father and asked about it, you know, and said, "Can they do that?" And he said, "Well, you know." And then he took a case to court and found out that they couldn't do it. However, most military dependents wanted to go anyway, and it was just, you know, the war was too close, and they felt that was better for him to go anywhere. But I think at least one, you know, as a result of that, some people that didn't want to go didn't have to go. And the fact that he fought the military, you know, there was no martial law, and I think that's the basis that he took it on. You know, that they couldn't order people out of, to leave their homes, short of being a martial law, and it hadn't been declared. So I think that he got a lot of notoriety out of that, a lot of support, you know, just the people, you know, that here's somebody that's willing to stand up, you know, and fight the army on their own ground, you know, and using the Constitution. Things like that were just, you know, I think were impressive to people. I've heard a lot of comments about that after that happened, and I went back to Kodiak here several years ago, and people that remembered my dad, you know, remembered things like that. They mentioned, you know, the fact that how he was, you know, that he did things like that, and they looked up to him, I'm sure.
In Cordova, do you remember any kind of
case? No, I don't. No.
Do you remember other stories about your dad?
I might come to think about them as they come up. But
how about in Fairbanks?
You mean stories? I don't know, but if you got two people to sit down, if you got Rabinowitz and I to sit down, or myself and Bogus, or, you know, three or four lawyers, and I'm sure that if one person started off with something, it would generate, and, you know, the mechanisms that people remember things by. I guess I don't want to appear to be hesitant about mentioning, you know, any incidents, but I don't know how important they are. You know, in the sense of the word. In an oral history, as to what people have done, or what, you know, what they did, and if it's even the truth. You know, Rabinowitz ought to be here. There's one case that I remember. It was after statehood, and Rabinowitz was on the bench. He was. Matter of fact, he had been, it was after he had taken Aaron's, no, it was after he had taken Aaron's Superior Court vacancy. And he and Judge Hepp were the judges here. And I was a district attorney here at the time. When statehood came along, and John Rader was the attorney general, I had occasion, my mother died, and she was in Seattle when she died, and I was on my way outside, and I had occasion to, John called me and asked me if I wanted to be the district attorney in this district. And I said, well, I'm on my way outside, and I said, when I come back, I'll stop back, you know, and told him the circumstances, and I did, and he asked me again if I would consider being the district attorney, and I said that I would consider it. I was in practice